the AM and FM 107 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. Well, today is the day. After a year and a half of work, today is the day that my new book is available. The Real Environmentalist, How Wayne Elliott and Other Capitalists Will Save the World. Please go and get your copy. Please, please, please. We would appreciate it so much. It's not just my effort. There's lots of us who have been responsible for this work. I want to thank Frank and Ivan in particular. Without them, the book would not have been possible. I want to thank Wayne Elliott, of course, the hero of the book. There's five heroes, but Wayne is our main hero. And I want to thank the other four heroes as well. And I want to thank you for purchasing it because that's what you're going to go do. Please help support the channel, me, the effort, and all of our desires to help entrepreneurs around the world gain the knowledge that we give out here every day for free. The only thing we ask in return is to go buy the book. We've got a great show for you today. Two fantastic women entrepreneurs. First up, we have Crystal Gibson. She's going to talk to us about agile and converting your business into a more productive house. And we're going to talk about her new book, The Authentic Alliance. Absolutely fascinating. And she has a system, and we're going to talk about that. You know, I love things with systems. And then we are going to welcome MC Powers, who's going to talk to us about a new humanity, how we're going to get back to a better humanity for all of the world. Great information. Excited for that. We will be right back to get started. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to introduce another great guest. Please welcome Crystal J. Gibson to the show. She has a long career and very successful, has just written a new book called Authentic Alliance, Empowering Sustainable Change in Complex Organizations. She has a company of her own and specializes in agility and digital. Crystal, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me. I'm great. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. Tell us about the book. What is an Authentic Alliance?
Authentic Alliance came about right after I finished my last job where I was an employee, right before I started my practice. I thought, wow, this would be a great time to take a moment and really think about what kind of lessons I learned throughout my career that would help someone else. So the book is really just a lot of lessons learned, and it's a playbook, a practical guide for anyone who is getting into this transformation, organizational change, agile transformation kind of work.
Excellent. Why did you write this at that time? What about just quitting your job and starting your practice made you want to do this? Seems like a good idea for marketing. What was your thoughts?
Yeah, so my thoughts were, I mean, when I first started in corporate America, there were a lot of untold, unsaid practices that people had. It felt like, you know, once you got into the organization and you had your cubicle, there were a lot of people who just seemed to know what they were doing, you know, all the time. They seemed to have the right words to say and the right emails to send out and the right etiquette and things like that. And I found myself, when I first started, really hesitating a lot, asking for, you know, waiting for someone to give me permission to do things, just really not knowing how to navigate in those spaces. So I felt like a book would really have helped me kind of accelerate that learning curve that I had when I first got into the organization. And then also there was some reminder sometimes in my career where I needed a reminder that, you know, I do belong in certain spaces, especially when I got into the technical world where not everybody looked like me, you know. So it was really to be able to provide that reminder for people who are in that space right now, and then to help anybody who's just starting out.
Oh, excellent. I love that idea. The very, very first day I ever worked in an office, I must have been 17 or something, and I was working at a very stuffy Coca-Cola office in the main Coca-Cola tower. And I'd been there 3 or 4 hours, and one of the guys came up to me and was like, "Slow down, Jim. You know, you're going way too fast." You know?
Right.
I was like, "Oh, okay." Yeah. So, you know, you know, you got to go slower, I guess. So,
yeah.
What are some of the lessons individually? Can we break it down? I know you have the charm system. Should we go ahead and jump into that?
Yeah. So the charm system is something that I noticed wasn't there when I started doing organizational change work. There were a lot of frameworks that let me know, you know, kind of how to assess organizations to figure out where they were in the different models, like the ADKAR model and things like that. But I didn't see a way to really start the engagement. What's the best way to approach it at the beginning? So charm is really the approach that you would take, just how you would start off when you first go into an organization, or how you would start off when you first interact with a team. So it is an acronym, charm. The acronym or the charm name came from me being a meditator for years. So I've been doing meditation for maybe over a decade. And when they say that you do your mantra every time you return back to your mantra, it's a charming feeling. So I took the word charm as my acronym for the framework. So C begins with co-creating. So you want to enter into the organization or to a team as a co-creator, not someone that you created this and, you know, this is what you're going to do. You want to get their feedback up front and make sure that it's the best fit for them, best approach. H is really honoring what they have in place already. So if they have existing events or things that are working, you don't want to just continuously improve over it. You want to just make sure that you honor what is already working in that space. A is for assess. You want to assess only the things that you want to find out. So you want to make sure that you have a clear understanding of what the outcome is going to be when you get the answers to maybe an assessment, or you have an interviews or anything like that. So just assess what really matters. R is, you definitely want to, after you assess that, you want to have a retrospective with the people that requested this information, the leadership team, the organization, the different teams that you spoke with. You want to retrospect, because there's also a narrative that comes after you provide the insights to the people who you spoke with. So having that retrospective, having that time for them to just provide more narrative or more story behind why those why that came out in the assessment is gold. And then M is measure over time. So don't just, you know, set it and forget it. Have the information after retrospective, and then over time, go ahead and measure what your success measures were when you first began, when you first decided that you were going to assess this organization. And then that is really the hub of the framework. It's just to have a framework to be able to understand where to even begin, how to do it in a systematic way, how to really see how people are doing in a systematic way that's sustainable, that you can duplicate over and over, quarter over quarter.
Crystal, what type of transformation are you working on? Do you specialize in? Can you be more precise about that?
Yeah. Agile transformations in particular are the ones that I focus on. So the ones where people are going from that traditional waterfall project management approach to being more agile and working in more of an iterative way. And then also being more customer focused and having more customer feedback come into the teams more frequently. And then also just the agile ways of working is also about a mindset change from the leadership team all the way to individual contributors. So that has been my primary focus, is just really making sure that people, organizations get their benefits from going through those transformations. Because as you know, they're pretty pricey, you know, once they jump into it. So just really focusing on making sure that people are getting what they want from it and people are having fun while they're doing it.
Right. So my wife is a programmer and she talks about Agile all the time. Why is there a process to implement it, or what are the problems? How is it hard? So I understand what waterfall is and I understand Agile. Why is there a big jump there that requires time and a bunch of money and stuff? Go ahead.
So the big jump is they see the frameworks that they have, like they have Scrum, they have Kanban, they have things like that, that they look so simple when you see it on a piece of paper, but it really requires a big mindset shift in the way that people are being measured for success. So, you know, in a traditional space, you're typically measured by like outputs, by like, did you just deliver that widget? And in an agile space, it's more about outcomes. Like, did that widget do exactly what the customer was asked? You were asking the customer really wanted. So it's just a really different mindset, different requirement for leaders to show up as being empowering change catalysts, as opposed to, you know, managing a person's day to day. Really trusting the people that they hire to be able to own certain things. So like you have product owners, the product owners actually need to be able to own the things that they are responsible for, as opposed to, you know, an executive kind of just giving those decisions and everyone kind of following suit into that. So the biggest shift and the thing that costs the most money is really understanding, how do you measure people in this different approach and get everyone aligned to the same goals and be motivated in the same way to be able to achieve what the customer is really looking for.
All right. When a customer comes in and hires you, what do you tell them about the process and how do they let you know what is wrong? Do they just come in and say, we tried Agile and it's broke? You know, what is the scenario like?
Yeah, the scenario is like they would bring me in and tell me about the transformation that they're going through. And then typically someone is, if you called me in, you're having problems. So I typically want to know, why did you initially decide to do the Agile transformation in the first place? And then when they tell me what the vision was or what the sale was for the original transformation, I'm really coming in to help them be able to get a little close to where they want it to be, or to really reimagine what success looks like for that transformation. So 9 times out of 10, if you bring me in, that you probably started off with a transformation that sold you a lot of dreams. And then you're more than likely you're seeing stalling, or you're seeing resistance from your employees, or you just really don't know how your teams are feeling or how they're doing. So a lot of the people that bring me into their organization are really looking for the answer to, how are my teams doing? How is everyone feeling? And how do I get them to the next level?
What about overseas workers? Does this work just as well for them? And how do you train them?
Absolutely. The most adoption I've seen in my experience has been with the teams in India. Also in China, they're very adaptive, especially with the goal setting approach. It's the same approach. It's just really understanding what the culture is in that space, as far as, you know, how they view hierarchy is a little different, and how they view success is a little different. Like, for example, the teams that I work with in China, they really wanted to know what the right answer was. So that ambiguity of like, you know, let's try this and experiment and see what happens, that was a little uncomfortable for them. But then when you flip it to like the teams in India, they love that. Like, they love to just, you know, experiment and see what happens and things like that. So it's really about just adjusting to what that group feels is comfortable. But yes, it's very global, and it really helps amplify a lot of great things that are already working in those spaces.
Does it make a global employee easier to have and to manage?
It does, because it requires a certain level of transparency. It requires a certain level of trust. And so there's a lot of different team building exercises that we do sometimes, just to really understand, like, what is your different motivators, just to understand or get that out in front of the team, where, you know, in a traditional space, someone might in another location might be kind of feeling like they're working in a silo. So it gives them more of an inclusive feeling. And it also just shares, and it allows everyone to understand what they're working on, and it allows them to everybody to learn from each other. So there's a big knowledge sharing opportunity in those spaces when you have that kind of team.
All right. Excellent. What about AI? I know that, you know, I watched a program on how to use AI or something like that on YouTube, and it said one of the best things that AI can do is act as a program manager, or just a manager of any kind of design work. What are your thoughts on AI and using AI to be a program manager?
Yeah, it's excellent. I mean, I definitely think it helps with those tasks that are repetitive. It helps with the low-hanging fruit. It helps being like a companion if you need to be able to just, and I'll get real particular. So if you're a product owner or a product manager, if you just need to break down your stories or your case studies or something along those lines in a way that is more consumable for your team, you could do that with AI as opposed to spending hours sitting there, you know, breaking up the administrative work. So I think it's really a game changer if you use it properly. The only risk I see is someone trying to use it instead of their own expertise. So it's not a replacement for being a product manager or being a project manager. You still have to understand the different fundamentals of the role so that you can see if AI gave you the wrong answer, you can talk back to it saying, hey, no, that's not right. I wanted to be more, you know, focused on this area as opposed to that. So you definitely have to have a human guidance. As long as you have an eye for it, I think it's a game changer.
What have you found useful with AI? Have you found any secret tricks?
My favorite AI tool is a tool called Gamma, and it creates PowerPoints for you. You can put in just like a little, you can either like copy and paste from like a Word document that you created, and it'll create the PowerPoints for you and put the images on there and everything. It saves so much time. I love it.
Ooh, that's a good one. Gamma.
Gamma.ai, I think.
Okay.
It's great.
All right. PowerPoint. We always need those. Go ahead.
Right. I do a lot of PowerPoints, a lot of presentations. So that helps me a lot. Saves time.
Yeah, but aren't the presentations pretty much the same each time? Don't you just fix one or two slides on the template?
No. So a lot of times when I'm in organizations, there's multiple teams in multiple spaces. So they each team has like a different thing that they need. So I tailor it primarily to what that particular team needs. So one team might need more role clarity, where another team might need more clarity or more direction on how to, you know, have discussions about making decisions. So I would never just do a cookie cutter for all teams unless it's something just very general, high level. Usually I tailor it to each team.
Okay. Why did you decide to go out on your own, Crystal? Tell us about your decision to become an entrepreneur and how you got your first clients.
Yeah, so my decision to go on my own was, it came from the return to office thing. So the company I was at had a return to office mandate. So I was remote and it required me to move to that state. And so I decided not to move to that state and give it a try of starting my own business here. I figured, you know, what's the worst that could happen? I just go back to work, right? Like, it's, this is something new. And, you know, after, I think I'm 2 years in now and it's working pretty well. I'm really learning how all of the information I learned from all the companies that I worked at before really feed into how I'm being able to be sustainable with my clients. Because now when I go into organizations, I see the same patterns. And I didn't realize that I was learning so much when I was working as an employee at that time. Now it's really showing and it's really shining through my practice. My first client came from a referral. It actually came from me being in a agile transformation group that met up on Saturdays, every Saturday. I think it's called International Transformation Group or something along those lines. And so I would join that group, that community. They would have meetups talking about different topics. And then one day, the person who ran the organization said they had a client that was looking for somebody and sent me a DM on LinkedIn and asked me, was I interested in engaging? And so I had the conversation with that company, and that's how I got my first client.
And now how do you market on an ongoing basis?
Primarily on LinkedIn, and then primarily through referrals. So it's really people who I'm talking to who have complementary needs that just refer, say, hey, I know somebody who is really good at transformations or really good at organizational change. Why don't you give her a call? I've had people reach out on in different business groups. So those business communities are very helpful to find clients. And then just word of mouth, honestly.
All right. That makes sense. That's where most people get it. So what about when culture is part of the problem? Do you ever have to go in and change culture?
Every time. And so what I typically do is I observe first. So I try to understand it first before I start trying to give any kind of guidance or suggestions. I really focus on mirroring it back to the people in the organization, because sometimes they don't realize it. A lot of companies, like the last client I worked with, they had people that were working there for 20, 30 years. You know, they really don't know outside of the company or know that that's the patterns that they're doing is an anti-pattern that is, you know, going against the change that they're really looking to have. So I start by just really ingraining myself into that culture. The hard part really with that is to sometimes you have to remember that you are not part of their culture and this changes for them. So not to get lost into their politics or things that are happening and really observe from a perspective of trying to help. But then once I feel like I completely understand, then that's when I'd show up with the leadership team and give guidance and suggestions and recommendations. And also model the behavior that I'm looking for by doing different workshops or exercises or facilitating discussions like decision-making discussions and things like that, so that they can kind of see what that culture shift really looks like in someone.
How long do you spend with an organization, and how do you know when it's time to end? Well, what if it's not time to end yet?
Typically it's about 6 months to a year. And when it's not time to end, I mean, I typically have the conversation with the client. I have clients who I still talk to on an as-needs basis. So sometimes we just have our official cycle that we went through is done, but ongoing, if they need to call me or have any kind of one-off Zoom meetings or just bring me in for a day to have conversation with their team, I'm always accessible to do that. So I just keep myself open for clients who, you know, they may not want to bring somebody new in to understand their company. They might need some quick answers real quick or quick conversations. So I definitely just keep the door open.
And now that you're a full-time two-year-in entrepreneur, how are you finding it? Has it been a success? Are you glad you did it? What have your thoughts been?
I'm glad I did it. I'm very surprised by how I manage myself. I think I'm finding that out to be. At the beginning, I think I was my worst manager I ever had on myself. So learning how to just really make sure that my schedule is not overly booked and I'm like not overworking, everything doesn't have to do with that, has been my lesson. But once I started balancing out my time and making sure that I'm completely focused on the client when I'm with the clients, it's been way better. I think it's really a transition too for me to be more on the outside looking into a hierarchy or looking into how an organization works. So it's definitely a different lens to work from. And I think it's fun.
And so what are your plans for the future?
So my plans for the future is I'm going to write another book because I have, now that I have more experience from a private practice, I want to put that into a book and share those lessons learned as well. I also have a playbook that I'm creating and also a few different workshops and a few different assessments that I want to create and just offer to the public so that it doesn't necessarily have to be an engagement 100%. For me, it's something that people can use on their own in their organization and then pull me in if they need extra support. So those are the things I have planned for the future.
Excellent. Crystal, how do we get in touch, find you online, all that, please?
Yeah, so I'm on LinkedIn. It's Crystal J. Gibson. And then also I have theauthenticalliance.com. That's the website for the book. It's theauthenticalliance.com. So I'm easily, you could DM me on LinkedIn or send me a message through my website.
Fantastic. Crystal, thank you so much for being with us. Great information and congratulations on the success. It's a great story.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we'll be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one.
You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question.
And that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to introduce my next guest. Please welcome Mary Carol Powers, MC Powers. She is the founder of Unicorn Creative and author of a great book called The Great Human Rebrand, How to Step Out of the Labels That Divide Us and Into the Humanity That Unites Us. Very excited to learn more. MC, welcome. How are you doing?
Hi there. Great, Jim. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Tell us, what is at the essence, MC, creative work, rebranding the humans? That's a big bite that you're taking.
It is a big bite. And it really comes from a background of being what I call a reformed master label maker. So in global branding and advertising, we created labels and we helped build untold success for giant companies on those labels and the stories attached to those labels. And you can see really quickly how labels can be good, but you can also see really quickly how they can do bad. So the reformed part of the label making is taking what I learned about making labels and learning to dismantle them to help people and companies leverage success in ways they didn't even realize they were not leveraging it.
All right. So what kind of labels, like hard worker, funny in the boardroom?
I would think those things sort of are more descriptors of traits. I think labels are gender, nationality, sex, and also within a company, labels, and I think I would love to talk more about this, sales, marketing, product. They divide us and have us focus solely on what is success for that department versus what the success for that department ladders up to success for us all.
Okay, that makes sense. Then how do we replace that?
If you click in one, like a label, I think of that as an identifying marker, right? Identity. I work in sales. I work in marketing. One click under identity would be individuality, which is what I bring to the job I do in sales or in marketing. So that could be hard worker, to use your example. That could be, a mentor. I could be nurturing and really know how to bring people along. So that brings both your hard and your soft skills together to help you lean in from a much more holistic place inside yourself to bring all your strengths to the table.
Okay. And the human rebrand, what does that mean? Is that the aliens come and take us out and make us slaves? What is a human rebrand?
So a human rebrand, that book, I break that down into three parts. One is understanding labels and seeing how they're used in society. As an example, if you think about it, we were all labeled as male or female before we were even born. And all of the cultural expectations that come with that are put on us before we even step, into the world and take our first breath. So it's understanding where these labels are, how they affect us, then taking the label of gender and dismantling it. So you can see, like what I talked about, what's an identifying factor, what's more of an individualized factor. And then the third section is what I call diversity deep dive. And it's really about monetizing your originality. So if you are a person, those are the unique traits, passions, skills, experiences that make you you, that would be yours regardless of your gender label, your nationality label. And if you are a company, it's beneath your product and beneath your logo, what you bring to that industry, to those customers, to really help them succeed. So it's taking the great human rebrand from a human point of view is taking us deeper into what our value is and leveraging that to help make greater success for both ourselves and other people.
All right. So I used to run summer camps. And at the surface, we ran summer camps. What we figured out 2 or 3 years into it is that we were taking unhappy kids and making them happy for the first time.
That's incredible.
Is that what you were doing? Is that what you're talking about here with the human rebrand? At another layer, one layer, we're just a summer camp. At a different layer, what we were really doing in cahoots with the parents was making unhappy kids happy for the first time.
That's an amazing thing. I would say what we do.
Is that the other layer that you're referring to?
The other layer I'm referring to is a deeper sense of getting to know yourself, your value, right? Beyond the obvious of what you give. So as an example, women were always traditionally devalued in the workplace for being nurturing. That was a skill for the home. Now, if you take that and translate that human value into a business value, nurturing is mentoring, and mentoring is a highly sought after skill. So getting to know yourself better by understanding the deeper level of what you have to offer and how that translates into value in the world that you are operating through. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. So it's a self rebranding.
The book is very individualized, and the company is very much helping companies leverage their unique individuality. And by corporate individuality, I kind of mean your brand, but in the startup world, I know brands are a little unwieldy sometimes because they can be very expensive to build. So more specifically, I mean your story. And that is what you have to offer and how you tell that to the world.
Okay. Now I get it. So I'm one of the people that don't have a story. I'm just one of the people. I'm just a person. I don't have a unique thing. You know, like how some people say, God made each of you to be unique and different. I'm not one of those. I'm just a random person that's the same as everyone else. You know what I mean?
Well, if I may, I would say no two people are the same.
Well, not the same, but, like I don't have a bigger purpose. I'm one of those people. I'm just here to be, not to solve.
I hear you. And I read your LinkedIn. I think you bring something really unique. Well, I think you're putting something into the world.
The LinkedIn thing, but the real me, the gizzard salesman, I'm just here to sell gizzards. That's all.
I see. I think, you know, if everybody were doing the same thing, there'd be lots and lots of shows like yours. And I don't think there are lots and lots of shows like yours.
But what I'm trying to get to is that there are a lot of people living in the basement right now who aren't unique, special gifts from God who think that.
So here's what I would say to that. I believe we live in a culture that trains us to conform to a certain standard of success that really rewards conformity. Look a certain way, dress a certain way, walk a certain path to succeed a certain way. And when you don't necessarily fit into that path, you don't get to discover what it is that makes you unique. I truly believe we all have personality quirks that are all of our own, that we all have innate gifts that we were born with. It could be as simple as I'm a good gardener. I got a green thumb. We all have like certain things that we're passionate about. We all have things that make us more, you know, get our ire up. And it's a cocktail of all those different things that create individuality. And might that seem super ordinary on the surface? Sure, but it's all how you leverage it. If I think about my favorite brand in the world, one of them is Life is Good. That is a stick figure, right? That is a picture of a stick figure on a t-shirt. By all accounts, that's pretty ordinary. Yet that went from two guys living in a van selling t-shirts to a global lifestyle brand because when they brought it together, it created optimism, and that is something the world is hungry for. So I think there is always a place to find a way to catapult higher.
Okay. And how does the person living in the basement do that? How do they escape?
So I would say get to know yourself better. What, rather than believing you have nothing to offer or everything you have is so ordinary you don't stand out, click deeper in. What were those things that you were super good at as a kid that you lost time in, you know, and maybe they didn't translate into a degree or even into a vocational career because the world said they're not valuable, put that on a shelf. What are the things you truly care about? Because if you bring a passion to whatever you do, you're going to perform better than average because you care. Like there are a lot of human traits that you can bring to who you are. So I would say to answer your question very simply, how do you get out of the basement? One, you get a deeper understanding of who you are. Two, you learn how to tell your story. Learning how to tell your story is the most important thing right now in this world of AI, where innovation is being democratized. And a lot of things are being taken off the table that were sort of like low-hanging fruit in the working world. Knowing who you are and how to talk about the value of that is the new moat, both individually and for startups professionally.
So how does the story go? So can you give me your story or my story or the president's story? Give us a story that so we see what the template looks like.
Yeah. So my particular story is I was born with the ability to write. I would have that ability, whether I was born male or female, whether I was of Irish descent or Asian descent, whether I was born American or born, wherever, Russian. That is a skill that I have. And I also happen to be born with a ability to like a personality to have to tell a story very quickly, have a quick wit, whittle things down. So when I combine my ability to write with my ability to whittle big ideas into understandable form, I created my value. That value served me super well in advertising because headlines go quick, 6-second attention spans. If you can be quick and funny and whittle it down, you get that done really quickly. So that's an idea of leveraging two very ordinary things. Lots and lots of people can write. Lots and lots of people have a quick wit. When you bring those things together, you create a value that you can then deploy, you know, in certain ways, in certain areas, advertising being one example of that.
Tell us about Unicorn Creative.
Yeah. Unicorn Creative is a go-to-market accelerator that focuses on storytelling for startups. So understanding what your value is, right? Your value prop, not being clear about that is one of the main reasons that startups, you know, kind of stall. And then how to talk about that in the world. So storytelling is something I see a great need for in when I look out in the world. And I'd be curious if you feel the same. Like when you scroll LinkedIn these days, do you see stories from startups and businesses that you really find compelling?
I do, yes. I don't know if it's scrolling LinkedIn, maybe it's just listening to the people on my show, but I certainly find amazing creative people all around, yes.
Yeah, there are a lot of great people out there. And in particularly in the startup world, one thing I see is a lot of people think their story is their pitch and that they should be telling their story. Well, your pitch is like what you want. I want you to buy from me. Your story is your value and what you have to give. So it's much more, less of the first person point of view and telling your story through the point of view of your customer and your client and what they're looking for. Because it's not a product, it's an outcome. Buyers go shopping for outcomes. Does that make sense?
Yes. I've always phrased it, you don't really care how much horsepower a car has, just whether it's going to get you laid or not.
Right. If that's your outcome, for sure. So I think a lot of people, like, you know, a lot of these amazing tech startups, as an example, are founded by really talented engineers. And their zone of genius is to build the features that do, you know, these great things in the world. But their zone of genius is not to translate those features into the human story that's going to pull people in and make them want to know more. And we have, like, you know, there's some stats out there that I think are truly interesting, one of which 80% of the sales process happens in the top third of your marketing funnel. So most people are looking and searching and researching long before they're reaching out. So you want to be talking their language, not your pitch, up there at the top.
What does a typical client look like when they come into your office, and what are they asking for, and how do you solve that problem?
Typical client that comes in has market fit and has had a few great wins and is a little confused as to why things aren't moving as quickly as they could be moving. And that generally boils down to one of two reasons. One is an inability to tell your value story in a compelling and human way. And two is hidden divisiveness in your culture that's really creating these separate siloed success standards that are slowing you down.
Okay. And how do you help them with that? How do you convince them that things just go slow? I mean, I don't want to hear that.
Right. I don't think things have to go slow. I think they are going slow because of those two issues. So we try to solve those two issues. And what we'll do first is create a value story, one that brings sales and marketing together into a singular unit, not this is your half of the funnel and this is our half of the funnel. If 80% of the sales is happening at the top of the funnel, it's an us problem, not a we or them problem. So we create one story that can be told cohesively through the entire funnel. That eliminates, like, confusion, that helps build trust, and that in turn starts to grow conversion rates, starts to shorten sales cycles, and then you aren't going so slow. So we both tell a more unique story that way, but also unify the go-to-market organization. And those two things together speed things up, and we've seen some really nice results.
Yes. How does AI impact your business? Is it now anyone's a marketing expert? Because they can just plop it into AI and type that back.
Yeah. So I hate to villainize AI. So I know there's so much of that out there, so I'm not going to go down there. I think it's a great tool. I think it's a first step. But AI is giving you the same answer it's giving your competitor. So it's gathering the same information for anyone who types in the prompt. So it's really not creating a marketing expert. It's just giving you some underlying insights that you then need to take and sort of funnel through your value story, your unique brand, your unique customer profile, and create something strategic. We just put a LinkedIn post up a couple of weeks ago that talks about how artificial intelligence needs actual strategy. And it's all about how to train your AI to work specifically for your goals, right? Like, you can put a chatbot in there, but if you haven't trained it to understand your objectives and your goals and to answer the questions in ways that help lead towards that, then you don't have a unique person on your storefront there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's a great starting point. I think, you know, AI has eliminated hours and hours of research for me, but it hasn't eliminated the way I then take my expertise and all my strategic and creative insight and use those things that are served up through AI to create something truly unique for the problems that are unique within any given customer that comes to us.
Yes. Yes.
One other thing I'll say about AI, which I think is really important, is it is changing marketing in the startup world. And we talked a little bit about this earlier. Because AI is democratizing innovation, right? Because, like, if you can come out with a new feature and over the weekend, someone could probably mimic that feature, which takes away your differentiator. So more and more people are turning back towards the branded storytelling, towards what makes you unique as a company to build out. So really, story is becoming one of the new moats.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. It can really create, as we like to say, it creates a castle in the mind of your customer.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really fun. And so what gets interesting there is, what is the difference between a brand and a story? Because they're not exactly the same thing. And I like to talk about this because brands can be cost prohibitive for startups because they can get really expensive. And therefore, a lot of times a brand is just considered, you know, kind of your logo, sort of your visual idea and your logo. And okay, I got my brand. But truly, what sits at the heart of every brand, big to small, is your story. Your story that orbits around value, that adds purpose, and that delivers a promise. Those three things sit at the heart of every brand. And if a startup could start with just those three things, then they can continue to build a brand on top of that, because that's the true foundation of any great brand.
Yes. What happens when brands lie, or even lie about their story? For example, eBay made up that whole thing about the Pez dispensers.
Yeah, well, you know, lies are short-sighted. They never, ever stay buried. And once you damage your brand reputation, once you lose trust, that's very, very hard to get back. So what happens eventually, and I don't know how long it's going to take, it depends on how savvy you are with your lie, but you are going to lose trust, and then you are going to lose business, and then you're going to become the butt of jokes and the cautionary tale for everyone else.
Yes. Did eBay suffer when the whole lie came out about their Pez?
Well, the fact that we're sitting here kind of talking about it and talking about them as liars,
and that's like 15 years ago. So it's persisted. The story is still 15. Oh, you know,
story right.
Perpetuated itself for 15 years.
Absolutely right. So that's 15 years of sort of being the butt of the joke, sort of being the brand you don't trust, sort of being a cautionary tale. Like, how much more might they have grown? How many more customers might they have had? How might they have innovated and expanded their brand if they didn't have to worry about damage control on that front? I don't have that answer, but you can see where it definitely was a detriment to their ability to grow. They had to play defense instead of offense.
Who has the best story
out of any brand in the world?
Yeah. If I ask that, what brands jump to front of mind?
For me, and I've already mentioned it once, the Life is Good brand,
right,
is, yep, one I think is amazing because of the simplicity on which it was founded. And you know, they still live their brand this many years later. They are the chief executive optimist and the chief creative optimist. Like, they really live their brand. I think that is an incredible one. I always hold Tom's Shoes up there because it was one of the first ones to truly take a double bottom line and build it in a way that people could be involved. It wasn't brand as hero. It was brand as catalyst to make the customer the hero. And I think that tying that point of purchase to the point of pain was brilliant.
Yes, it was. But then
how about you? What was your favorite brand?
I don't know. But once you've done that, like Tom's, no one else can do it again, and it's sort of off the table, isn't it?
No, I don't think so. I think there are way too many problems in the world to solve for one person to do that. I think there's lots of examples. I think what Tom's did was build it from the ground up, and they used shoes. It was a one-for-one thing. Warby Parker then turned around and did a one-for-one thing. Warby Parker still has their own brand. They have their own personality, and they're doing good in a much different way. Both of them are helping the health of the world, be it through the eyesight or, you know, through the diseases that happen when you don't have shoes when you need them. But I think they're unique brands, and I think unique double bottom line brands can manifest in lots of different ways. And the more good you do for your company, the more good you can do in the world. And I don't think we can have enough of that personally.
Well, that's very well said. MC, how do we find out more? Follow you online, get in touch.
Yeah. So Unicorn Creative, and it's creative with a K. .com is, you can find us on our site and see how we tell stories for startups. The Great Human Rebrand is available on Amazon, and we are on Substack and LinkedIn, putting out insights all the time to help people in any way we can for free.
Fantastic. I love that, for free. Appreciate you being with us, and we'd love to have you back. Great stuff. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. And before we hang up, can we do the Fast 10?
Sure.
I was told I needed to ask.
Yes, you have to ask. Do you want to accept the wager?
What's the wager?
The bet that everyone else makes.
Which is?
You know, the thing that everyone else does.
I don't know what that is, so I hesitate to agree.
But you can't. Number one, your favorite creativity hack.
I'll be watching a movie or cooking, because they both reframe creativity into fun and not work, which loosens my mind up for more ideas.
Number three. Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick.
Invest in quality vitamins and a good yoga mat, because bootstrapping means you got to do so much more by yourself.
Number three, name your top passions.
My husband, my family, which includes my dogs, writing, inspiring and being inspired, however that happens, and throwing a killer party.
Number four, the first three steps in starting a business are...
knowing who you are as a business, knowing who your market is, and knowing how you can best help that market succeed.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
Listen, you need to understand what someone actually needs versus what you want them to need. You got to shift your mindset from getting a sale to giving support.
Number six, your dreamiest technology is?
The one that actually works without spiraling me into a flurry of four-letter words.
Number seven, best entrepreneurial advice.
Be humble enough to know that you don't know everything, and let others lead in the moments when you're unsure.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake.
Thinking only like a business person and not also like a person. Human connection is what makes the business world go round.
Number nine, favorite entrepreneur and why?
So you're not going to be surprised by this one. Bert and John Jacobs, who are the founders of Life is Good.
Number 10, favorite superhero.
So I'm going to step out of the Marvel universe here and give a different answer, because everyone is a superhero in their own way. For me, Dr. Seuss is one of my all-time superheroes, because he managed to make being weird enchanting and turn his oddball nature into an empire.
All right. Very well said. How do we get in touch? Find more? What are all the URLs again?
Yeah. Unicorncreative.com. And that's creative with a K. MaryCarroll.com. That's MerryCarole.com will take you to the book, or you can find that on Amazon. And we are always on LinkedIn and Substack, giving out insights and ways to help people succeed for free.
Fantastic. I'm just kind of pausing until, oh, I've just been given your score. You got a 94, which is an excellent score, but you have to have a 95 to win. So you owe us a Tesla. That's what we were playing for.
Oh, got it. Dang.
any caller you want to send over, we will accept gladly. So thank you.
Excellent. Jim, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time and the platform.
And we appreciate you being with us. We are out of time for today, but you know what we do. That's right. We have this habit of coming back tomorrow, and we will do it. Thanks for being with us. Take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.